And now, welcome to Chai with Manju, with your host, Dr. Manju Shen.
Hello and welcome to Chai with Manju. Our special guest today has the most famous last name in the world and also the legendary charisma of the Kennedy family. He's fondly called the torchbearer of a legacy. Joe Kennedy III has been serving the citizens of Massachusetts since he got elected in 2013. And now, of course, he's running for the Senate. Let's meet him and learn about his vision. Congressman Kennedy, welcome to the show. It's such an honor for us to have you with us today.
Doctor, I'm so grateful and very excited for it. Thank you for having me.
So let me first ask you, what has this COVID pandemic been like for you and your family?
Thankfully, and we've been very, very fortunate. I've got a two-year-old and a four-year-old. They're healthy and well, and my wife is as well. So thank God for that. 14 weeks of more or less quarantine can get a little bit trying with two little ones who wake up every day and essentially try to burn the house down. And some days are reasonably successful. But we've been very fortunate, particularly compared to obviously so many families across the United States and around the world that have been devastated by the impact of this virus. It's been a, doctor, it's been disorienting, right? It's been, on the one hand, grateful for me to be able to spend some more time with a young family, more time than I certainly would have. Challenging in trying to be a member of Congress and seeing so much pain take place across my community, across our country, and watch the federal government struggle to respond. The president struggled to respond in the way that we needed them to. Inspiring to see the way in which essential workers answered this call around the country and have shouldered this enormous burden so that the rest of our society could function. From a perspective of a candidate for Senate in Massachusetts at the moment, somebody that believes that politics is supposed to be about people. But to do that, you got to be out with people. And we can't be out with people. And so that's been challenging and frustrating. I think the virus has also shown that we have really deep struggles within our society, deep issues around healthcare, deep issues around fractures within our economy. And we need to address them, and we need change to do that. And so I look forward to being part of it in the months and years ahead.
Now, going back to the beginning, you are from a family of renowned politicians with a history of enormous contributions to the public service. Now, what was the best advice that you received from a family member when you decided to enter the political arena?
The best advice came from my dad, and he said, don't do it. I took that to heart, and I say that only tongue in cheek. But he pushed me really hard not to, which I think many people were surprised of. They'd say, hey, this is something your family's, a field your family's been involved with for a long time. It's something that is more familiar to me and my family than others. One in which my dad still pushed, and he served for 12 years in Congress, but pushed very hard against me to before I decided to enter my first race for Congress. And I'm really grateful to him for doing so, because the point that he made was politics can be really hard. It can be really challenging, and campaigns are difficult. Some of the most difficult things you will ever involve yourself in, certainly professionally, but it takes over, and it requires a commitment, not just from yourself. It requires an enormous commitment from those that you are closest with. That everybody has to contribute to it, everybody has to roll up their sleeves, and everybody has to give up an awful lot to do that. And so he pushed me really hard to, one, make sure I was ready to do that myself, to make sure I was ready to ask that of other people that I loved, my friends and family. And if you're not willing to do that, to know that because it will get hard, and when it does get hard and you have the press asking tough questions and you have people distorting your record and your past and the rest of it, if you don't have something inside you that says, I know that this is hard, but there's a reason why it is worth it. There's a reason why you're doing this because I believe that politics is an essential part to try to make our country kinder and fairer and more equal. And you have to fight through that. But if you're not ready to make that sacrifice, if you're not ready for that challenge, then by all means, don't open that door, because after you do, it's coming. And he's right. But I am.
Now, this is your fourth term serving the fourth congressional district. Now, while you've had so many accomplishments, what do you think has been your best achievement so far?
Doctor, I'm really proud of my leadership in healthcare and the efforts to and help lead the way to protect the Affordable Care Act and try to make good on that promise in our country that everybody gets access to the healthcare that they need when they need it. For the richest, most powerful nation in the world, that shouldn't be too much to ask for all of our people. And the fact is that that should be the lesson that this Trump administration takes away from this virus and the COVID-19 pandemic. It's that, doctor, your health and my health are linked. That we're not going to be able to address a pandemic if we say, hey, we'll have access to care for those who can afford to pay for it. But for those that don't, those essential workers who we praise for keeping our grocery stores stocked and for the long-haul truck drivers that make sure that there's food in those stores and the clerks that are there stocking those shelves and all the people that we depend on, if they don't have access to healthcare, well, one, who's able to do that? Two, that just means the virus is going to keep persisting in our society and we're all going to get sick. Yeah, and so to learn that example and say that if we're serious about this, it's not just the right thing to do and the moral thing to do. We do this because it's the only way to navigate through a pandemic. And so whether it's been on the protection of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of mm-hmm. for the expansion of Medicaid and the myriad ways in which this administration has tried to roll that back, to fighting to help people understand the extent of a crisis of mental and behavioral health care we have in this country. I'm proud of the contribution I've been able to make and want to continue doing so in the United States Senate.
Okay. So on talking of that, on September 21st, 2019, you announced that you will run for U.S. Senate. How and why did you decide this was the best time to run for this position?
Because we need stronger leadership in the Senate. We need stronger leadership in government. And doctor, I believe that back in September, looking around our society and seeing that there were, look at that point, before COVID-19, right? There were 500,000 people a night that were going homeless. There were 37 million that were going hungry. We had there's not a single neighborhood in our country where a minimum wage worker could afford a two-bedroom apartment. We have the highest rates of incarceration, and I do not think you're going to address the structural barriers and challenges that not only led to those problems I just articulated, but have been compounded by the threat of a novel virus and some of the oldest sins of our nation when it comes to structural racism, white supremacy, and the legacy of slavery. And I don't think you're going to address those issues by sending the same people back to Washington that haven't addressed them over the course of their entire career. We need change, because our society before, that normal that so many want to go back to, was broken for far too many.
So what has the virtual campaigning been like? You know, the studies show that only 25% of 25-year-olds vote. Now, do you think this virtual campaigning is what's better with the young people?
So virtual campaigning has been, there's parts of it that have been certainly an asset. There's parts of it that have been very frustrating, candidly. The benefit of it is that you do have a broad reach, right? You can get to, when we do Zoom meetings like this, you can talk to people literally around the Commonwealth, Massachusetts, around the country, around the world, and you can bring them together in a way which obviously that technology existed before, but people weren't as accustomed to doing it or as used to doing it. So that's been great. The problem and the frustration I have with it, doctor, is that, as I said before, I believe politics is about people. And it's about the way we come together in a society to address the challenges that affect us all. And it's about being collaborative and meeting people where they are, listening to their concerns, asking questions, and mm-hmm. trying to synthesize the solutions there that unite us, and then act on them to actually address those concerns.
Okay. I'll tell you, though, you know, you do that Facebook Live once a week. I know a lot of young folks, including my 22-year-old, they actually look forward to that and listen to you.
You're kidding. Oh, good. Thank you.
So you might actually see a lot of these younger folks. So I feel, you know, it's sometimes down the line, the virtual will play a role.
Yeah, so, I agree.
So what do you think of electronic voting and vote by mail? Because there's certain people who feel, there's some people who feel that the universal vote by mail will cost Massachusetts somewhere between $12 to $30 million. So what is your opinion on that?
So the estimates for Massachusetts are in total about $10 million, which when we are talking about the investment that it's necessary in order to make sure that we protect our democracy and protect our healthcare, I don't think that's even up for debate that that's a worthwhile investment to make. So vote by mail, I think, is a critically important piece to ensuring that we can protect our democracy in this in the midst of a really important election, regardless as to what side you come down on it. This is an important election. From the presidency to governors around the country and senators around the country, all the way down to city councilors, and school board officials, and other local races. And so certainly critical to make sure that we aren't forcing people to choose between protecting your health and protecting your vote in our democracy. But vote by mail itself is not sufficient. Just because we pass the legal accommodation say you can vote by mail doesn't mean that necessarily everybody's going to understand how that process works, make sure they're registered to be able to access it, knows about it, if there's a public awareness campaign behind it or not. If the mail piece itself isn't easily identifiable as an actual real ballot, there's a bunch of different complexities that come into this that indicate that this is not the sole solution to this problem. When it comes to voting, Dr. Government needs to meet people where they are, right? And so there's a whole series of reforms there, from automatic voter registration to pushing back those registration deadlines, same day registration, which I think is critically important, to then expanding early vote so people can actually go down and vote in person if they would prefer to do so, increasing the number of locations that they can in fact vote in person, increasing polling locations on election day, vote by mail, and again the resources put behind that vote by mail program, all of that needs to be done just to try to make sure that people lead complex lives. They've got a number of obligations and responsibilities. We should be making it as easy as we can for people to be able to make their voice heard.
Yeah, I agree. Now, what will be your top three priorities if you win this election?
A couple of things. One, we talked about healthcare, particularly with regards to mental health, and that's going to be a big priority of mine, always has been. Mm-hmm. Two is the structural reforms necessary to protect our democracy. So, these are wonky, but they are, I think, what's necessary in order to ensure that our country, part of the frustration that we feel is that our country, our government, is not responding to the will of its people. Mm-hmm. It's not doing that because of the way the structures that are in place to protect entrenched interests. And we need to clean those interests out. You need to do campaign finance reform. We need nonpartisan redistricting. We need to strengthen the Voting Rights Act. A series of reforms that we had passed our first bill out of the House with a new Democratic majority, H.R. 1, to actually make our country more responsive to its people. We talked about healthcare. The other two I would point to, clearly climate. We need to address a climate crisis. It's an existential threat for me and for my children and for our planet. And we need to recalibrate the wheels of an economy. What we've seen here is not that globalization doesn't generate significant resources. It generates trillions of dollars. It's just that money stays with a small slice and doesn't get to everybody else. And so we need to recalibrate the structures of our economy so that it empowers American workers and American families to be able to get what they deserve, but then take care of themselves, meet their obligations, and invest in their families. And those are going to be my priorities going forward.
Right. So I have a fun question for you.
Okay.
Like today you were traveling again from Boston to Washington, D.C. And if you're on a train and traveling, who would be the person you would like sitting next to you, either from past or present, 100 years ago? You could pick their brain, get some advice.
Well, the one person, if I had a chance to have a conversation with, and I don't mean to make this a downer, it's a great question, but it would be my grandfather. He's obviously, I never got a chance to meet him. But I think, particularly how he was able to his ability to empathize, his particularly towards the end of his career and as a informed by his time as Attorney General and then as a U.S. Senator, the that empathy that turned into an anger at the inability of a country to actually recognize the plight of some of its people and to know that we had the ability to do something about it and chose not to. But to be able to pull together an extraordinary disparate coalition to come together to actually demand better of each other and better of our nation. How he was able to do that. You know, somebody that I know from the stories that have been passed down was, you know, an incredible dad and could be very tender and could be very tough. I'd love to be able to have that conversation with him at some point.
I have to tell you that it's really been nice that you have reached out to the Indian American community. It was such an honor for us to have you at the New England Choice Award last year when we honored many eminent people from our community. And of course, we honored Sushil Tully, leader of CEO of Leader Bank. So I want to thank you for that. Now, do you have any message for the Indian community, a community which is a little bit laid back on voting, I must say?
So I think this is a critical moment for, or can be a critical moment for the Indian American community. It is an extraordinarily influential community in Massachusetts, but across our country. And as we look around the world, the opportunities for not just domestically for an Indian American community to exert its influence, but particularly internationally. There's obviously enormous challenges and tensions taking place right now between India and China, between the United States and China. U.S. foreign policy is still looking for its footing with regards to Asia. And the world's largest democracy should be a deep partner and a deeply intertwined partner with the United States. And I think that means the United States has to can be more deliberate and intentional about reaching out to India, but to the Indian American community here that has such deep ties in the United States and back in India, and leveraging those ties for stronger relationships between our two nations, but also understanding the enormous capacity of an Indian American community domestically and here in New England. Look, Massachusetts, you look across our institutions here from higher education to medicine to business. Sushil Tully is a great example with regards to what he has done and what he has built at Leader Bank. It's extraordinary. And I do think that the opportunity is there for an Indian American community to come together and raise their voices and help make sure that candidates for office understand the enormous impact that an Indian American community can have. And once they do, they're going to be able to make sure that those voices have an influence in U.S. policy for literally generations to come.
Right. And this is a time where every vote literally counts.
Every vote literally counts. It's election's a big one, right? And so, and I say that not just because I'm in it, right? I say it because the decision on this election's, and look, in September and then obviously in November, determine the trajectory of our nation for a long time to come. And so, I think, and that's going to have dramatic impact on the United States and on India and on relations in Asia and China and the rest of the world. So,
yeah. I think globally we are at crossroads. Yep. And I think all the decisions we make in this time are going to be very critical.
Yep, I agree. So,
thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the show and we wish you all the best.
I am so grateful.